Newton Institute for Mathematical Sciences. My name is Christy and I'm the Deputy Director, and we are delighted to be hosting this second special event, a discussion on art, string theory and M theory, to mark the end of Grenville Davies' tenure as artist in residence at the Newton Institute. Before introducing our speakers, let me tell you a little bit about the Isaac Newton Institute. Based in Cambridge, the Newton Institute is a national facility that supports mathematics research throughout the UK. It's funded by research councils with contributions from LMS and other charitable trusts. Although its role is a national one, it receives significant support from the University of Cambridge, for which we are all grateful. In addition, it has a development board of lay supporters who fundraise in the city and elsewhere to ensure the continuation of high-level research in what is an uncertain future in terms of funding from public sources. We may be biased, but we think that this is a very special building. It's essentially one large open space with approximately 20 participant offices leading off it, not to mention over 130 square metres of blackboards, including blackboards in lifts and in the toilet, and they are used. It's a truly wonderful space for nurturing both individual and collaborative research, as evinced by the 22 Fields medalists, 7 Nobel Prize winners, 18 Wolf Prize winners, and 7 Abel Prize winners that have been participants in our programmes and workshops over the past 20 years. In addition to Grenville's pieces of work that we will hear more about presently, we'd like to draw your attention to a number of other works and artefacts that are in the Institute, and I'd like to draw your attention to a few of these. In the library, we have a portrait of Newton by Sir Godfrey Kneller, a leading English portrait artist in the late 17th and early 18th centuries. There is a bust of Dirac, a Nobel Prize winner and, like Newton himself, Lucasian Chair of Mathematics here in Cambridge in the 1930s. We also have a bust of Newton, his death mask, and one of my favourites, a maquette of Newton by the renowned sculptor Paolozzi. You might also have noticed the 3 geometric sculptures by John Robinson on your way into the Institute. Before I introduce our 3 speakers, please let me first get a couple of housekeeping matters out of the way. If the fire alarm sounds, please vacate the building and congregate in the car park beside the main building. And also, mobile phones. Please switch off all mobile phones now. Even in silent standby mode, they interfere with our audiovisual equipment and will cause a buzzing noise that will be streamed live to the world and archived for posterity. So without further ado, I'd like to introduce our 2 speakers. Dr. David Berman is a reader in physics at Queen Mary College, University of London. He is an expert on M theory, which is an extension of string theory, and he has just finished organising our programme at the Institute on mathematics and applications of brains in string theory and M theory. Professor Grenville Davy is a renowned English sculptor, famous not least for winning the 1992 Turner Prize. We're delighted that Grenville agreed to be the first artist in residence at the Newton Institute, and it has been a joy having you around, Grenville. As you can see from the pictures here, he really embraced life at the Institute, and we were particularly thrilled that our trademark blackboards influenced his work. So, on to our discussion. Well, the first question that I'm sure everyone is fascinated to learn about is, how did you meet and how did your collaboration come about?
So I've been interested in the idea that science had influenced, or contemporary science and physics had influenced artists for a long period of time. In particular, going back to the beginning of the 20th century, when relativity and quantum mechanics had a big influence on the artists and composers of the time. So I obtained a grant through Queen Mary to have an artist who was interested in being influenced or inspired by the sort of research done in contemporary string theory. So we advertised that, and there were many applicants. And then we chose Grenville out of that And I should say that one of the reasons is that Granville's work was a lot to do with relationships between things. It was to do with, it wasn't about one object on its own, but about a relationship. We'll talk about that more later, but that was sort of how we first met.
Yeah, it went, I made the application, and it went very quiet for quite a long time, actually, and I hadn't realised there were so many. I can understand why so many people would want to apply. There are some images on the screen up there, but there's a consistent element in my work right throughout 20 years, which is fascination with pairings of objects and what that does in a fine art context. Okay, galleries, not so interesting for me, but I was absolutely fascinated to find out more about what David had to offer. I had no idea what he had to offer. In essence, it has established and answered a few questions for me to do with the relationship between art objects, individual objects, pairs of objects, and the relationship to the viewer and metaphor. So we started drawing, talking, breaking things, making things. I think that was the basis of the early work, wasn't it?
So, do you want to say a little bit more about why you decided to collaborate? Did you shortlist? Was there a chemistry? You know,
I wanted to embrace or somehow engage with the world beyond just immediate theoretical physics. You know, string theory's got a problem in that it's a fascinating area of science, but there are not really engineering applications. And yet, somehow I felt it was very conceptually rich. And so it was good to sort of go into the arts. But then you sort of seek out, well, what's the right medium for that this can be expressed, these ideas can be expressed in. So I put forward a call for artists to apply. And we had 220 applications of artists of all types. And then we shortlisted it down to 10. And we interviewed them. And it was a very difficult task because the medium was everything from performance. I had some dance people. There was a guy in tango who wanted to teach me tango. We had sound artists. We had great painters, sculptors. And there was something about the geometry and physicality of sculpture, which I felt fitted in with how I think about physics often, in terms of a sort of geometrical, physical thing. And so that was what part of the fact that Granville was one of the few sculptors that applied that really appealed to me. Mm.
I think I generally start with a circular form, and that is really quite, I think, has a relationship to painterly. Has some kind of painterly quality. I make frames, I make carcasses, and I make outline structures for things. Nothing appears from a thought in one hit. And we talked about this a lot this afternoon, is that there's an exchange of relationships all the time. It's over time in the studio. And I think I talked about painting quite a lot.
Yeah.
Not that I know an awful lot about painting, but I was interested in the return gaze, often the subject in painting, which has been fascination for me. And I think we established quite early that there has to be a kind of stance or a position taken against whatever is produced or with whatever is produced in order to define some rules. That makes sense to you, yeah. I think.
I mean, yeah, it started, I had this idea, because of Granville's work, bring about relationships. And there is a thing, perhaps we'll talk about later, about duality. So duality is about the relationship between physical theories, in some sense, and the idea that they're different faces of one structure, and that you see a duality because it's a different face of one thing. That linked to me Granville's things. And so I explained this to Granville, and we had a whole load of drawings that were built around having pairs of objects that were related in particular ways. And then they fixated on some of the shapes that Granville was interested in. And then to me, I was very keen on, well, there was this sort of almost rigid mathematical relationship between the two. And then slowly we moved away from that rigid mathematical relationship. Although in the back of my mind, that was always part of the conceptual basis that there would be a relationship between things. And that's what we're trying to bring out in some of the works. then it evolved. I mean, you produce stuff, and then you've got to see what it looks like, and then you've got to decide if there's genuine aesthetic value. That's where I learned to let go of what the meaning of things was and just go with what's there.
So do you want to talk a little bit more now about the process of how you collaborate? So you're talking about what it's doing, but the process, what do you actually go about, how you exchange your ideas, how you talk to each other? I mean, you speak very different languages, or probably initially, you're speaking different languages, so how have you gone about this process?
Well, essentially, I think, I mean, David will come to my studio. I deal with material. And often, I mean, I think what may be hidden in this is obviously it's made of stuff. But in the studio, I deal with stuff that's been transformed. And that may be held in a state, or it may be made invisible, may not be obvious. David will come around. I think you had a grasp of that. I mean, I'm very hands-on. And I have a kind of tactile understanding of how things might be. I draw, and you sort of draw in a way. You do. I mean, it's not a criticism, but you're not. I don't know. You know, there's a really kind of very instinctive understanding about what approach or where you're coming from. As I said, over time, I am surprised, David, about what's going on here, what I've seen here, the speed of what happens here, as was described with these boards, which may be common to you, but process of drawing for me is very, very fast and sometimes repetitive, and that is a fundamental way to get into the point very quickly. It's speculative, okay? So materially, things that are happening here are very fundamental to my artwork. I hope that makes sense. I remember from a very early age, quite an additional teacher of mine being able to at least impress me by the speed of working and then the ability to just destroy absolutely everything in one hit. I mean, which was great. And I do that all the time. But also in parallel to that, like this process really has been about allowing things to develop over time at the same time. So I guess there is another kind of duality there. All right, does that make sense? Yeah.
So has the process of collaborating changed at all whilst you've been artist in residence at the Institute? Has the dynamic shifted at all? Has the environment changed how you work? Is it more intense?
I've got to go back to saying I don't know if you can draw or not. I'm not going to teach you to draw. I think this is important. There's stuff I've heard here and stuff I've been witness to that I want 100 years' time, if I'm still alive, I might be able to grasp. But I'm not here to teach, but I'm here to sort of witness what's been said and try and grasp some of the key things that are fundamental to the way I think, but they're always tested. I think that's the thing. So,
I think from our discussions, what happened with Grenville being in the Institute was very much, we spoke about collaboration. When we did the collaboration at Queen Mary, it was just the two of us, and it was sort of an experimental thing in some way. I think it exposed Grenville to how people work in mathematics and physics, which is a far more collaborative structure. Whereas, we discussed this before, artists are not that collaborative in some sense. I mean, there are, but it's not as fundamental to how things progress as it is in mathematics and physics. Mm. And I think, Grenville was sort of exposed to the whole collaborative atmosphere, and then just the physicality of some of the things, like the blackboards, was a big influence, as we discussed maybe. Because that's so inherent to the Institute. I think people who are not mathematicians or theoreticians don't realise how much we love chalk and wander around with boards and that thing. And you talk about drawing and erasing. Mm. It's something that you do all the time in research, and you put an idea up and then it goes and you rub and you... And for me, working with Grenville, what surprised me is the number of things that we built and we drew or actually made pieces, and they hung around for even 6 months. And then they're abandoned or thrown away because somehow it didn't work, which I only became aware of after a long period of time. I began thinking, when you design this thing, you build it, it's there. And then to me, the learning process was that Gremble worked in the same way that we do. You start with an idea, but then it has its own life and it evolves, and then you're by what's actually there, present in front of you. And that was a great learning experience for me, at least. The evolution of a collaboration in art is not dissimilar to what I've had in mathematics or physics.
Occasionally throwing it away and
throwing a lot away. Throwing a lot away. I mean, yeah.
So something I'm interested about. So this has obviously been a very good location. You live in Essex, and the Institute is here, so this has actually been good for you two working together. But, you know, you're going to return to Queen Mary's, you're going to still be in Essex. How do you see your collaboration continuing from here? You know, how and when are you going to meet? How where will you find opportunities? What do you see as the future for this collaboration?
One of the things, we're planning, hopefully, to have an exhibition in the Contemporary Gallery in London. We've got some pieces there, and there's some other pieces that are not on show. Some pieces are currently in the Financial Services Authority building on show there. We've had some other pieces at the Launchpad, and it's attached to the Royal College of Art. So it's somehow, to me, it's about sort of taking the ideas which I know and love in string them theory and slowly investing them virally into the art world in various ways.
It is really difficult. It is not difficult in the traditional art sense to do, but to did you say infect? But to what's out here is work that's been kind of sort of rattled to a point where it's ready to go. And it's almost in disguise, but I would love to see one object in a context that I'm used to, but invert the whole process and have a group of objects related to it in different contexts. So you bring the story back to here.
Perhaps it's worth saying again, the thing which perhaps you see when you go back is that each object on its own is not really the thing, it's the relationship. Not just in the pairs that you'll see, but the pairs to the other pairs. So you'll see a common theme, and there's a repetition, and that's important. So it's not that we really want one object on their own to stand out, or even one pair, but through having sets of things, you're sort of brought into that whole relationship, focusing on relationships in some sense, and connections, rather than the individual thing itself.
So you've been talking quite a lot about relationships and connections and duality and things like that, which are obviously very important to you, Gremble. David, could you talk a little bit about the mathematics and the physics that is behind the work that you're both doing together?
So string theory, one of the main aspects of string theory that's very remarkable is something called duality, or in particular, say, T-duality, it's called. And that says that there are geometries, shapes, that you think are very different things. They appear very different. They are different from one perspective. But for the string, this fundamental building block of nature, they are the same. The string cannot tell the difference between two things which appear very different. And this is a duality, because it connects two things which appear different, but they really sort of infer each other. There's a strong relationship to each other. If you like, it's almost an ambiguity inherent in the fundamental description of nature. So this is a sort of major building block of string theory, and it's something which I've worked on and extended in some ways in research. And that sort of focus on duality in a geometric sense is what these works echo, somehow related to. I mean, I should say, don't go to the works and think you're going to understand T-duality. That's not going to happen. It's not about explaining the concepts in physics. It's about the fact there are concepts in physics like that that can then influence these sorts of works.
Okay, now I'm going to put you on the spot, David.
Yes.
And I'm going to say,
might not be...
No, I'm going to say, maybe not everybody in the audience knows where the string comes from in string theory. Why
okay.
string?
Can I get you to delve a little deeper?
I'll do 5 minutes on string theory. So string theory is a very simple idea, actually. And it comes from questioning what people always assume to be true. From the Greeks all the way back, that the most fundamental building blocks of nature are like points. And then what string theory does is say, but look, supposing the most fundamental building blocks of nature are not like points, they have extension, like pieces of string. They're little tiny, so we can't see them. So they look like points to all intents and purposes until you go to those very small scales. And then instead of being infinitesimally small points, they really have string-like behavior. And then nature becomes a bit different, because there is now not the infinite regress to the point, but there is a scale, a size in nature, that is given by the size of the string. And so string theory is a theory which says every single bit of matter, every force, the different modes, different vibrations of this string. That's a theory which then challenges nature from its base level, because it says that the smallest distance scales can't go any smaller because there's these strings there. And the strings themselves have got size. So you brought in into nature that size does matter, that depends how big or small you are. There is a natural length scale, a natural length to nature, given by these strings. But then we're just points. The Greek atom, that you could go smaller and smaller and smaller. Never stop. Infinite regress into the smooth spaces of geometry. With strings, that all changes, because everything, the forces, the matter, are all made up of finite-sized objects.
So these finite-sized objects, like strings, have the strings themselves fed into your work?
I was often concerned with surface and contained spaces. I think one thing that's happened now, particularly through the drawing, and it's evidence in some of these objects, is that the things over that float over the surface of the object are really sometimes concealed. So a radius is crucial. It's probably something that you can't gain or achieve in a drawing, for example. It's something you might directly achieve in an object. But the thing is that I've, in the past, and there's some photos here, there's a kind of superabsorbency to a painted surface, for example, that will take you into an object. I think with some of these, there's a surface that kind of floats on the edge or over the surface. And that's really come out of drawing, that a three-dimensional thing is truly three-dimensional. That's obvious. It might sit on one point, but your relationship to it is... my relationship to it has changed. And I think, as I said before, that the some of the things that I thought were proposals in terms of kind of painted surfaces, for example, were to do with what was concealed underneath. It's quite interesting for me now that having to reapproach the drawing I make, and I'll re-stress that drawing is really crucial and a beautiful thing to do, is that it's become very, very crucial to get it incredibly accurate. All right, that's a very open thing to say. I remember a point in this sort of like, it felt like a bit of a bracketed point in working with David, that the need to repeat drawing, the need to repeat the process was really, really important. There was nothing made apart from drawing, which is great. And they're not revealed yet. I guess you get a chance to ask me what I mean. Okay, it comes from working with material. It comes from a kind of painterly concern with surface. Yeah, the artificiality, if you like, of a surface, really. Or the artifice, if that's the right way of putting it.
So do you think, Jim, that this relationship with mathematics and physics that's come into your life, as it were, do you think that it's had an impact upon your practice and, you know, even your career as an artist?
Yeah, it's great, because people say, what are you up to? And I can tell them.
No, it's right, because it's so engaging, you know, and it's lovely, actually, it's wonderful to kind of know that so many people are really switched on and engaged. And I kind of make the evidence. The evidence is out there. Yeah, and it's very pleasurable. It's really pleasurable to be sort of taken this way.
So do you think it's changed the works of art that you're producing? Do you think that has there been a shift in what you're producing due to the influences of mathematics and physics?
I think with some of the groupings and some of the pairings, I have extended that kind of range of knowledge I have. And I've given that a context which it's never had before, and that's something I'm really, really, really interested in pursuing. In the past, they've always sort of poked their noses through the traditional linear art world understanding of your work, which is where I've lived for quite some time. Does that make sense? Not a bigger picture of the story of the art. It's a putting to one side and pursuing a part of the work more vigorously. That's where I want to go with it.
So really, I would, before I open it up to the floor, I'd really love it if you could talk to us a little bit more about the different pieces that are out on display. Hopefully lots of you have had a chance to look at what's on display out there already, and I'd love it if you'd talk to us about, you know, where some of the objects came from, how you came about discovering them, what you did with them, how you created them, and the stories behind the works on display.
Yeah, I think there are two pieces out there which are very definitely maquettes, and I think there's a big difference between a maquette and a something else. Okay, the pair with the hardwood centre right over against the far wall, that was made as a maquette to propose something that's nearly 2.5 metres diameter. So that's a piece that's doing a job of work in oak, very, very large.
And what were you planning on the final version being in?
Oaken Corten steel, which is a rusted steel. So it's a very large scale piece. Okay, the five objects on the slate have become a maquette because they're arranged like a maquette for a larger piece. And the others, as I think David said before, they are more akin to my, you know, in terms of my working method, where I've tried to set up awkward relationships with things that have the appearance occasionally of ready-mades, like the wig stand. Things that have a very concrete kind of materiality, like the tube, the little eye holes. There's a thing that looks a bit like a pumpkin or a pagoda in the far corner, which has eyes as well. I remember 20 years ago or so, going to Naples in a museum and seeing a pair of bronzes, life-size athletes, adolescent athletes. And this is something I just remembered again, actually, is these figures just about to run, 6 feet apart. Obviously, what was really incredible about them is that their eyes were painted. They were green bronze, but their pupils were painted in, and they were absolutely symmetrical as you could be, unnaturally symmetrical, which was a wonderful thing to see, pairs and pairs. Okay, I'm kind of back into that mode now, but that... the relationship between the viewer and the viewed and the pairing of objects isn't random, it's kind of fluid. And I think that's something that's in three or four of these things. Some of the two red objects which are leaning on one another are pretending to be formal. They are all kind of handleable things, okay? Don't be worried about touching them. There are a lot of the work is made of oak, which I love. Often wet oak, which is wonderful at drying out really quickly and doing unpredictable things. Okay, so they are meant to be kind of working objects. Okay, is that?
That's very good. So can I throw questions open to the audience?
Well, I have another question for you on the spot, David.
You're not going to ask me to draw, are
you? No, I'm not going to ask you to draw. So, one of the things that it seems to me that Grenville is really interested in is how his objects change and decay, and you're actually interested in the decay of your piece of work, and you like them to be on material that can warp or rust or whatever with time. How do you see that? How does that sit with mathematics? Do you see theorems
like
decaying or warping or rusting with time?
So I don't see that of theorems, but when you look at the piece. So, but it fits in with the physical idea, which I really want to mention, and it's very poignant. So when you go out there and you will see these pieces, which have many of them a beautiful circular symmetry, when you look closely, you will see that symmetry is broken at the small scale. And you'll see it's broken by different things in different cases. Typically by the texture of the wood, by the cracking of the wood, this decaying process, this process of nature leads to the breaking of symmetry. And that is a sort of physical idea in some sense, that we have in nature a very symmetrical thing. The laws of nature are very symmetric. But how they're realised ends up that they're often broken. And indeed, you know, this week or last week when we had the Higgs particle announced, the Higgs particle is about a spontaneous breaking of symmetry in nature. And when you go and you look at these things and you see these beautiful circles, but you look at the detail and you see there's some broken symmetry there. And that's reflected in this process, so either through the rusting of the steel. I mean, there's a very nice thing with the pieces just out there. They are cast iron and then they are treated with zinc oxide, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then with salt and then water. And then as the water streaks down, gravity provides a sort of streaking and that breaks the symmetry of the circles. And that is somehow reminiscent of this idea. You can have symmetry that breaks.
And do you think that strings broke the perfect, beautiful symmetry of particle physics?
It's the way around. String theory is beautiful in the ugly world of particle physics.
It's a challenge.
It's caused and broken the symmetry of string theory, but...
So maybe that contradicts, and maybe it's going in the other direction.
But I think that the point is it's about the fact that you can begin with a sort of naive view of mathematics about symmetries and structures, but one of the things we've learned to embrace in physics is the breaking symmetry. And that's a key part of it.
So another question for you. Yes, please.
I have one question. It's regarding these figures that you have made. What does it take to appreciate them and to make the link between physics and this art? Because I am a physicist, but I am in a completely different field. And basically I am a normal person looking at this. And I mean, what does it take to appreciate and to make the link between the physics and the actual shape that they have?
Well, I think I've worked with landscape architects and all sorts of people from all sorts of different positions, and somebody said, well, it's all for the good of humanity in the end. Well, it is. I mean, you create great landscape. You know, we're generating these things and they can be put out there. And what we're trying to do here, I guess, is to say, well, I deal with material. Okay. Sometimes people go, oh, no, not material. You know, oh, what, stuff? Maybe it's difficult to grasp, but, you know, the transformation of material in my world is key to creating this. Yeah. So there are all sorts of levels to do with maybe understanding that. Formal questions, questions you might ask but not express. Ask yourself but not express. That's all really good stuff. Yeah. So this relationship maybe has been done lots of times before, but it's all new work. Yeah. I think that's key.
Yeah. I mean, I would say one shouldn't take the attitude always that when you look at a piece of art or read a book or anything like that, that you need to absolutely decode the authorial intent. You need to go there and decide what it means to you. And if you're happy, then I'm happy, and Grenville's happy. And that it was never about communicating the ideas of duality in string theory. But there's something about, and some of the pieces that are not out there have got maths on from my equations. And I've exhibited those to artists, and they don't understand the maths at all. But there's a thing whereby you sense it means something more. I mean, there's a feeling that you get when people put structure into something that you can sense there's a structure there and it means something more, even if you don't know what it is. So you don't need to understand that. You're not going to know about duality. You don't need to know that. But if you get a feeling that there's something more and there's a relationship between things, then you've understood it.
I've got another. Oh yes, please.
So, in the history of sort of abstract art, you know, Western art in the 20th century, I mean, there were many sort of ideas from maths that sort of got into art: lines, straight lines, geometrical patterns, sometimes very symmetric, and then circles and other curves and some of the more random patterns and so on. There was sort of a vocabulary of geometrical ideas that were very richly used by many artists. Do you feel that you were, sort of by learning a bit about string theory or trying to capture the ideas, you were learning some really novel ideas that could be used in an artistic way, that were taking you away from that traditional vocabulary of 20th century abstract art?
Yeah, that's a really good question, actually. It's a really tough question. But like I said, I tried to get to before, you know, the rule book I've got about drawing in my head, sometimes, I don't know if it can be broken, but there's some additional rules that are not clearly spelled out yet. I can understand some, I'm trying to think of an example. For example, well, we talked about Henry Moore before, understanding more about why these connections are made in a sheet of drawing, you know, in a group of drawings. I'm trying to deal with that. I deal with circular form, I deal with it in a painterly way, I deal with circles because you have to have a position against them. I guess that's a fairly traditional way of working. Am I getting to the right point here? Am I interested in trying to break something? Well, I was very interested in what David had to talk about and made drawings about, which were inverted, or suggestion of inversion, or inverted objects, okay, which was, in your case, a live sphere. And I kind of thought, well, why would I want to do that? Yeah, I mean, why would I want to do that? Because I was very interested in the form that was presented to me, you know, a tangible thing. So there was no theory about that. I think this is an ongoing project, I hope. I think I've always worked on the next object. I mean, there've always been groups of objects. I think that's another interesting thing. I'm not sure I'm getting to your question, because it's so tough.
I think the thing I picked up that was perhaps particularly novel from string theory is what you said earlier. I mean, this idea of pairs of things. I mean, you know, you go into a gallery, you see some impressive work, but it's one object. And you somehow together perhaps seem to have got this idea of, you know, looking at one thing in two ways, which perhaps was an idea from string theory that wasn't there before.
Yeah, you see, that's what I was trying to get clear earlier. The sort of midpoint of this relationship, if you like, was just above the surface of the object. And it was very interesting with this donut. I've drawn so many times, there's something that you can't put in a drawing which is present in the drawing now, which is kind of drawn in and raised. Okay, is that, it's often associated with a radius. Yeah, it's very hard to describe that if you make drawings, that the drawings that have kind of somehow expressed that are not visible. Okay, so maybe something you could do in an object with a surface. I put often with something that's on the screen now, for example, I understand steel and working with steel, and if you understand steel well enough, then you can weld in a certain way to put the stress in the object, so an object starts to resonate. Okay, you can also break that. But I've never kind of experienced that in a drawing before, or making a drawing.
I think it was when we started to draw, I was drawing things always with the idea that there would be a dual pair. So even if the pair wasn't present, it was implied.
Mm.
And then that hit on the sort of thing that Gwen was talking about, that when you do it many times, you then see it, even when the pair isn't.
Yeah.
Do we have any other questions? In which case, I might round this up, but just conclude by saying that I completely agree that Grenville and David are doing is they are looking at one thing in two ways, but in a way, they're also looking at two things in one way, which I think has just been a real joy, and that's why we've really loved having you as part of the Institute.
Thank you.
So maybe the conversation can continue
over
a glass of wine. So may I thank you very much.